Chapter 5. Ash and Gary Form a Partnership. Beware of the Ides of March. William Shakespeare. Several years passed, with the Jeffreys climbing the success ladder and seeing the world as never before. With every project, Ash grew more self-assured, and after understanding there were bigger things in life for him, he took to thinking of starting his own business. He didn't share this with Indira for some reason, perhaps because he thought women need the comfort of home, the nest, the daily grind that to brilliant people is only a moment's task, the kitchen, and so on. No, Indira was happy where she was. The future could stay like this for 20 more years with no changes, and she would revel in it. But he, man that he was, and brilliant as he saw himself to be, believed it was better to make his own money and leave the company instead of giving them his all. And he reasoned he had everything it takes to make it. And hey, I'm young enough. That failure is but an obstacle on the road. I'll get back on my feet if I fail. Meanwhile, back in Minnesota, the young man Rock Anderson was packing his bags for a move to California, where he would start a new virtual business with brains, sweat, savvy, and the savings in his pocket, a chunk of cash from his first enterprise at age 16, when on weekends he shined floors for big companies downtown. This was not a janitorial business, but an opportunity to leave luster wherever we go, as he enjoyed explaining his business to others. City Hall contracted his services after the mayor walked into First Bank and noticed his own reflection in the marble floor. Seeing the floor was shinier than his shoes, he abruptly asked the manager for the contractor's name and promptly summoned Rock Anderson to his office at 3 o'clock that same afternoon.
"Mr. Anderson, I want these halls as shiny as Gandhi's bald head," said the mayor. "Get downstairs to the contractor's office. They're waiting for you to fill out the papers."
He looked at the young blonde walking out the door.
"By the way, young man, just how old are you?"
"I'm 16, sir."
"Well, I'll be damned. At your age, I was chasing girls and dealing with my pimples. Good luck," he said, picking up the phone, then starting to ring.
Rock Anderson had no self-doubts about who he was, nor what he could do or any challenge that lay ahead. He simply thought of something, got on the road, started to do it, and learned everything there was about the subject along the way. Sort of like climbing a high mountain without a walking stick or a care in the world. Being a man without hang-ups, he was going to get to the top one way or the other. For him, it was just work that lay ahead and nothing more. Growing up, his dad was his hero, a funny man to be around. Old dad just let his son run wild, do what he wanted and pay for the consequences, like when scraping one's knee. It bleeds, it hurts, and you put a Band-Aid on it and keep on going.
"Life was simple. It is we who complicate it," he told his son repeatedly, teaching him that anything was possible as long as you put your mind to it.
Young Rock Anderson thought about these words for a long time. Just put your mind to it. What does that really mean? He didn't ask his dad for the answer. He just, well, put his mind to it to understand. Although it took a while. A few years indeed, but he did finally understand that concentration and dedication mixed with perseverance will do the job for you. Those three elements are a power of their own, he concluded at about age 21. By then he was on his way to being a self-made millionaire with 11 full-time employees working out of an Orange County warehouse, shipping goods to stay-at-home moms all over the country. Years later, he would learn that his best friend and venture partner customarily ordered Rock's products for his wife. That's how good Rock Anderson was with business. He sold his products to 1 out of 10 homes in California, some of them still seen today on kitchen counters. Years later, when asked how he did it, how he became successful at such a young age, his answer was,
"Well, my parents never censored me. They believed in me, and so I believed in myself."
Gary Truby, the very person who Ash wanted to emulate before deciding to make the boss his role model, looked every bit the triathlon man that he was. His strong, protruding jaw and big teeth gave him an aura of invincibility, as if he would just eat you for breakfast without so much as a second thought. The natural, longish blonde hair bespoke of a private school education, a reserved emotional nature, and an enviable social status often detected in well-raised East Coast types like Robert Redford. His tie was a perfect Tudor knot, his shoes lush, the coat and tie bit never overdone, his pocket chief accenting his blue eyes. He carried nothing, as powerful men never do, not even a pen. His presence alone sufficed to get the deal done. In reality, only someone with upper-class upbringing could dress like Gary Truby, and good taste does not grow on trees. Ash reasoned, he works for the company. I've dealt with him many times. His work is good, and he brings gifts of cake and ice cream every Friday afternoon. Nobody does that. Gary Truby would befriend you if he saw something to gain from it, though his motives would only be discovered after the fact. Ash readily accepted Gary Truby because he carried with him the air of a British heir, a convincing manner and an inherited charm that took anyone else years to acquire. Gary seduced Ash Jeffrey to partake in a new and exciting capitalist venture, which promised to triple his investment. As those he charmed into ventures were sucked into the game, few questioned Gary Truby's sincerity or even suspected the elaborate scheme planned to leave you befuddled and heartbroken in the end. Ash Jeffrey was one such individual, charmed into Gary Truby's deceitful ways, although it sounds an unlikely thing given Mr. Jeffrey's radar for bullshit. He did fall for the scam after being convinced the venture looked promising. Ash readily accepted the offer due to Gary Truby's convincing manner and the inherent charm that took any plebeian years to master. I have a connection to a big contract, he whispered to Ash one early evening after the office emptied for the day. They were in the building alone, so what better time than now to jump into a plan of action? Ash glanced at Gary Truby, but returned to his work. I'm listening, he said. Well, you see, we would have to start our own company, he said, splitting the word into three for greater effect. Ash fell for it. He reared back his head. Go on, he encouraged Gary. It is better we discuss over a drink. I'm due for a good martini. Ash liked the discussion, loved the numbers, so he went home to tell Indira that soon enough they would be spending more time together because he was going to be his own boss. As Indira was preoccupied with a new ceramic piece, she responded casually and without taking it in. Do you really think this is a good move? While keeping her eye on the mud, the whirring sound of the pottery wheel spun her husband's words into infinity. When Ash gave his 2 months' notice, the boss's face fell to the floor. What are you doing, Ash? There's a mountain of work to be done. I've treated you like a son I never had, given you everything. Do you need more money? Just tell me what you need and I will take care of it. But Mr. Jeffrey had made up his own mind, and it was time to go out on his own. The time is right for my professional growth, sir, he said, his voice unapologetic, a most serious look on his face. This decision has nothing to do with your company. It is purely a selfish move on my part. This kind of opportunity doesn't come every day. The boss looked him over. The scorn on his face did not yet show. I'll make you a partner. Would you like that? I've already discussed it with my attorney. Nope, that didn't work either. Ash thought it was too late. The boss sat on this offer for too long. There was one last attempt to be made. Boss would call Indira. Maybe she could talk Ash out of it. When an individual decides to do something, there's no stopping that individual. This decision is a two-edged sword, because things don't always turn out the way we plan, and the decision can come back to stab you, and believe me, it can land right in the gut. Ash was ready to take action on his decision, and there was nothing Indira could do or say to make him think twice. Ash's confidence was at an all-time high. Life was still getting better and better, so why not clinch some of these inside contracts Gary Truby promised? The worst thing that could happen was that Ash would have too much work on his hands. But that was easy to resolve. Work more, devote more time to solving problems, and keep on no matter what. Sooner or later, the world would open up and he would have unqualified success, such that he would be envied by even the most successful people on earth. The boss soon found a replacement, and Ash was given 3 days to clear his office. He was not given a penny of severance pay, because in effect, and legally speaking, Ash resigned his job, but was fired, let go before completing the 2 months' notice. And no attorney in his right mind would want to take up a legal fight against a company overlooked by the U.S. military. His boss would have to make do with the overload, the fury burning in his veins, because he intentionally treated Ash Jeffrey in every respectful way, and now he felt betrayed by what he saw was Ash Jeffrey being overconfident and even flippant. Needless to say, the relationship ended badly. Meanwhile, Gary Truby was nowhere to be found. A few days before Ash was asked to clear his office, Gary Truby had secured Mr. Jeffrey's balloon investment, his life savings, and disappeared into the great unknown, leaving the new company to fend for itself. Every attempt to snatch Gary Truby in the deception proved fruitless. He called every contact number of Gary's, but only got disconnected numbers. Emails, of course, were not returned. Ash thought Gary might have taken a flight to Washington, D.C., where the contracts were said to reside. But that proved to be of no use, as the con man had mentioned names he was unfamiliar with. Now Ash was out of a job, broke with no future, his savings gone, and his wife infuriated because he did not listen to her advice to take the company's offer of a partnership after the boss called her. A false success had gone to his head. Ash had allowed greed, instead of gratitude, to rule the day. In effect, ignoring Indira's suggestion to keep working for the company that took such good care of him, although never mentioning the boss called her requesting her help.
"I tried talking to you, Ash, but you did not pay attention. You were too attached to your outcome, and so here we are. When I insisted you take the partnership in the company, it was in our best interest. A woman seeks comfort and safety."
No attorney in Chicago would take his case without a $50,000 retainer, and to top it off, finding a certain Gary Truby would prove to be an additional expense, as investigators soon called home asking for his whereabouts, adding that apparently this Gary Truby rakes it in as a con man. How the boss hired him in the first place, Ash would never know, as he was now officially persona non grata in the aerospace industry. Ash quickly returned to the self-loathing of his youth, thinking he had that part of his life conquered. The old shadow cast itself over him as if swallowing up his soul. The letdown was a stinger. Gary's assurances raced through his mind over and again, driving him to a deep meditation under the trees in the park. There was no going back to the good times. His relationship with Indira was now a silent one, with the nights turning into long, hollow moments of regret. Ash Jeffrey looked about and found his life empty. The biggest mistake he made after being fired was not looking into the future. After looking for work in Chicago and finding none, he called a high-profile headhunter who took his information, only to receive a cold shoulder on his follow-up call 3 days later. "I am sorry, Mr. Jeffrey, but we suggest you look elsewhere." They shut the door on him, a door that in that field of work would never again be opened. Ash would have to reinvent himself, Indira said, sensing what happened, without ever being let in on the Gary Truby episode. Oh well, so much for the American dream. But it was good while it lasted. So, just when Ash and Indira thought things were bad, good news turned into worry. Indira thought she was pregnant. Staying in the United States did not seem like a good idea, though birthing would certainly assure the child's U.S. citizenship. Money was running out fast, Ash held to his pride, but Indira said,
Ash, we cannot eat pride.
The food bin was being emptied, though Indira knew how to ration. Her husband nearly blew his stack, but kept it inside until a few days later when he exploded, but not at home. It was very early one morning when, unable to sleep, he put on warm clothes and walked over to Oz Park, where he stared at the Dorothy and Toto statue and shouted, This is just an illusion! Disappointed with America, he would find a way to carry on. Knowing he was responsible for his actions, he sat on a bench and let it out. The tears, the disappointment, the frustration, hate in small portions, for this was not an ebbing emotion. Self-blame was, and one he was deeply familiar with. His once overwhelming low self-esteem returned yet again with blazing speed. The familiar feeling in the pit of his stomach, wanting to vomit, dizziness, a cold chill ran through his bones. And that was when he knew that, despite achieving the American dream, he was still little old Ash Jeffrey. Disappointment. He knew going out on his own would one day prove to be his best move, but now, the baggage of failure, coupled with the possible pregnancy, was enough to make him want to hide in a cave, or better yet, climb into a hyperbolic chamber to forget everything. Yes, Ash wanted to hide and disappear, go away, leave this earth, die, but he couldn't. It was not time yet. He still had things to do in life, accomplish big things. He had no idea what those things were. See his firstborn, maybe grandchildren, love Indira more, and get back on his feet. But he would need help.
Father-in-law says to go home, that he will put us up,
Indira said the next day. Ash looked her in the eye, wanting to strangle her. No, he really wanted to strangle himself for being such an idiot, but he projected the feeling onto her. I think it's the best thing to do, he finally answered, after clenching his fists and pounding the dinner table.
He sent plane tickets for the day after tomorrow.
Indira's words were final. London it would be, Ash returning along with his wife with a baby due. Did you tell him you're pregnant?
I would prefer to say it to their face. Perhaps the blow that's due you will not be so severe.
Indira knew father-in-law would give it to Ash. He would make him feel 3 years old again, beat him with words, berate him until he could take it no more. His father's position at Lloyd's of London gave him an air of authority that he used whenever possible. And besides, he'd always belittled his son. Why should things change? The thought of crawling back home to London awakened a terror in Ash, one that he could not share with the world, for his father was a tyrant who got under his skin. This was his little secret in life, alike the one Indira kept in her journal. It would be years before he shared this with Indira, and by then he had other secrets to take to his grave. The doctor called the next day to inform Indira that she was not pregnant. Something else was going on in her body, but he did not know what ailed her. I recommend you see another doctor, perhaps an immunologist. I'm a simple family physician. Even the doctor, it seemed, was pushing them away. If you think it's cold in Chicago, London will be a summer breeze to you. All you have to take in is the constant rain, the humidity that crawls into your bones, leaving you feeling rheumatic, and endless cloudy skies that make you want to scream, especially if you spent many lovely summers in Chicago, a type of daylight that no Londoner will ever see. The sunlight brilliant, the trees in arrogant green, the sky clear with a light breeze near the edge of town. Now, though, Ash had to make do with his place in life. Asking around for old mates from the university, he found one with a good profession, his own business, but no time for the down-and-out Mr. Jeffrey, who was essentially thrown out of the United States, where without a job, the visa expires, an embarrassing experience for anyone. Word got around, don't ask how, that Ash had failed miserably in Chicago after starting out like a champ. Nothing else was known, no facts presented, but someone said something to someone and the rumor hit the mill. It was probably his brother, Hakim, because he was deathly jealous of his older brother, Ash, and wanted to belittle him in any way he could. Hakim did have the best teacher in the business of demeaning, in the form of his father, the elder Mr. Jeffrey, whom he took after, and who he grew to resemble in his every expression and gesture. Ash was glad he didn't fall from the same tree, though he was more like his mother than his father in most respects. But old Dad sure got his goat when he wanted to. The problem was that Ash did not know how to stave off the attacks. Regardless of his father's passive-aggressive nature, he still loved him. The elder Mr. Jeffrey was so self-serving that he took every action around him as an insult, as if the world revolved around his wants and needs. Even at work, others were getting tired of his antics, but being in a high position and well-liked by those who mattered, he continued on, pressing employees with downgrading glamour and self-righteousness. No wonder Ash turned out the way he did. Dad asked Ash to take a walk with him the day he returned to London. As the women prepared a welcoming dinner, Dad let him have it. "I am terribly disappointed in you, Ashley," he said, using his birth name, as was the custom when upset with his son. All others knew him as Ash. "You have great capabilities. You are a star. You supersede anything I have ever done in life, which is little, but I gave you everything possible for a bright future. Yet you fail me miserably. I cannot for the life of me understand this." Ash felt beaten. Beaten by failure, beaten by being home, beaten by the lousy London weather that he now detested. Beaten at this very moment by his father when instead he needed to hear words of encouragement, of hope, in order to get back to the success mode. "Is this why you asked me to walk with you?" He turned around in the direction back home, but was stopped by Dad's stern voice. "Ashley, I am going to help you in every way I can, I promise. I will take a loan, if need be, because I want to see the son I know with a big house in Chicago, instead of this run-down beggar standing in front of me." "Geez, Dad," thought Ash, "kill me with kindness, won't you? You've every right to be upset with me, Father. I truly see my shortcomings. Why don't you help me in that area, that I might return to my old form?" Dad stopped walking, taking a deep breath before speaking. "There are some things in life one has to do alone, son, and that is your work to do. I will support you until you change things for the better." Father was not just a beast. He was also a kind man, once every 100 years. Turning now to Ashley, he hugged him momentarily. It came to mind to Ashley that he could have used this hug as a child years ago when he wanted so desperately to find out how to cure his low self-esteem. The hug, however brief, would do. "I know it is a crude manner to welcome you home, but you needed to hear it." With that said, Dad took his son's arm into his and headed back home to the dinner and drinks that awaited them as if nothing had transpired between them. It was the start of the Jeffrey Wars, the 21st century version. The Jeffreys, it was said, had been at war with each other since their name change back in the early 1800s, when they were known as the family Chintabattini, from the Krishna district in India. The name was common among the Tamil peoples. As in most countries, resentment to indigenous peoples in their own land exists as a way to push and shove the original people from their lands. The Tamil are widely disliked and resented by other tribes in India, and the primary reason is due to their dark, almost black skin. Although the majority of this tribe is Hindu, small groups of Christians and Muslims live among them, and not in harmony, one might add. But there are other reasons for this discrimination. The Tamils have a documented written history dating back 2,000 years, something that cannot be said of other tribes in the country. And to top it off, the Tamils are the single largest ethnic group in India without a homeland. Therefore, they're considered to be gypsies, roamers and poachers in some instances, and suspected of being disloyal to their host country. Ash's mother then, feeling of a different and superior tribe, disliked Indira, whom she insisted was one of the Tamil ethnicity. The next hit Ash had to withstand was twofold. First, now back in London and depressed, looking for work he could not find, scrambling for money for day-to-day expenses, living hand to mouth, Ash noticed Indira was becoming more reserved than he'd ever seen her. At the beginning, he thought it was her way of distancing herself from the rigors of the Jeffrey household. Then it was back to his belief she was disliked by mother due to her almost black skin coloring. So finally, Ash allowed her to just be herself, come what may. It did not occur to him to dialogue with Indira, as the two were drowning in failure, both with their own reasons of things. Finally, he saw his wife nearly collapse in the living room while serving afternoon tea. Jumping up to save her from crashing to the floor, Ash looked her over and noticed her face was pale, her eyes limp with the internal energy he knew so well all but vanished. "I'm taking you to the doctor," he voiced aggressively. Mother, who was waiting for her cup to be served, stood on her feet.
"For God's sake, Ash, what is the matter with her?"
"Well, if I knew, Mother, I wouldn't be taking her to the doctor. Call a cabbie." Mother was not accustomed to either being talked to like that or taking orders from her oldest son, but she complied, calling for a cab immediately. In a minute, they heard the honking of a car horn. Indira was diagnosed with a rare ailment for which there was no cure. The doctor told Ash she had a good chance of making it, but she had to be bedridden for the duration until her energy returned to normal and that the hospital would do everything in its power to define the illness and seek a remedy, though he did not use the word cure. Ash considered London was to blame. Perhaps Indira became ill as a result of the English diet and bad water and the cold weather after becoming accustomed to life in Chicago. She laid in bed for several months, getting on her feet once a day to make her way to the bathroom down the hall, after which she needed help to return to her comfortable pillows and warm blankets. While others were out of the room, Indira mustered the strength to journal. It seemed this was the only thing keeping her alive. Ash found it unbearable to sleep next to her, so he took to the living room sofa where he would read his eyes to sleep with books from ancient Hindu mythologies. In those books, he found peace, understanding that man has always confronted the lion, at times losing the fight, other times getting through hardship by mere mindfulness. Mindfulness is today a Buddhist concept, as borrowed by a Vietnamese monk who took refuge in France during the American invasion in Vietnam of the 60s, finally setting in a monastery outside San Diego where he lives today. As a piece of Hindu thought, mindfulness is the practice of full awareness from moment to moment. It has also been appropriated by 20th century French philosophers as existentialism, with its famous catchphrase, "here and now." Ash found his concept of mindfulness helpful, yet cumbersome during those 7 months separated from Indira, who he could not see for more than 5 minutes before breaking into tears like a child suddenly abandoned by his mother. He needed emotional support as much as she did, but it was Ash who was not there for her. Indira asked about him all day long, worried and wanting to vomit from this strange ailment, but Mother would only say he was out looking for work. In truth, Ash felt paralyzed with fear and disappointment, spending most of the day reading and sitting in front of the telly watching cricket games, in which the Indians were pounding the tar out of the whiteys. "It's a funny thing, Dad. Cricket is an English sport taken to India, essentially taught to us by them, and now we beat the Brits to a pulp and they can't stand it." Ash had insight, said something no one dared to say on the street, though true. Indian cricket players were the best nowadays, and there was no denying it. Old Dad smiled with joy, thinking of his proud heritage.
What are your plans, son?
The pressures and worries of unemployment rushed back into Ash's system, the paralyzed feeling now numbness. He sat straight to answer his father. The thought of changing his life was a necessity. He had thought it over quite seriously, considering Indira returned to her old self, planning to recreate himself into a functioning, successful human being with a hefty amount of self-esteem. The aerospace industry was now in his past, dead to him by all means and purposes, so something new was in the making. Dad waited patiently to hear his son speak, folding his hands on his lap, tapping his shoes on the floor, as he always did when impatient. This did not go unnoticed by Ash, who spoke boldly. Father, I have decided what I will do next. He picked up the book he was currently reading, the Bhagavad Gita, raising it to the heavens like a Baptist minister does the Bible. This book was Gandhi's spiritual dictionary. It teaches selfless action, and although I must be selfish in rebooting my life, there's an aspect I understand in this philosophy, and that is to help others see themselves as they truly are. Meaning the greatest within, the power within, the taming of the lion. Father looked at his son, his face crunching up, his eyes beady in a show of displeasure.
You are wasting your time, Ashley. Get real. Do something real that will make you money and get you back where you belong.
But this is what I have chosen after my downturn. This is us, Father. It is our DNA, the Hindu way of thought, a new door opening to get to the other side. At the moment, I don't particularly know how I will use this philosophy, nor do I know what I will do with it, but I can tell you one thing. I'm convinced this is my new path in life, and there will be no stopping me.
The elder Jeffrey shook his head.
You must reside in the world of reality, Ashley.
This is the world of reality. This is our culture, and I'm tired of hiding it from others, pretending I'm something else, because after all, I am not a Brit. I'm Hindu, of Indian descent, your son. This is a part of facing my fears, a chance to come to terms with that which I have been resisting my entire life.
Are you blaming me for bringing you here to a better life?
I said nothing of the sort, Father. I am grateful you improved your life as much as ours. I truly am. Yet for most of my life, I have felt divided inside, as if I am supposed to be loyal to the Queen, yet do the same with my tribe. That duality has not served me well.
Father looked at the floor while thinking of a response. He had to get the last word, but maybe not this time. He too loved his India. He too sometimes felt divided in his soul, as if he were untrue to himself by accepting mistreatment by the whiteys.
It feels like self-betrayal to accept denigration, he thought, admitting just how often he'd had to withstand unacceptable comments from higher authorities without the opportunity to respond for fear of being dismissed from Lloyd's of London. Dad now slouched in the sofa and raised his hand. The gesture was an old one from Ash's youth, one meaning to stop talking because Dad had to say something.
My son, and I call you that because you are my blood. What makes you think you are the only one to face a separate reality in this, our social place? Do you think for 1 minute that I did not have to shoulder the slings of arrows of misfortune, as Shakespeare wrote? Do you think that I simply migrated to this country and everything went well? You are mistaken if so, because although I have never spoken of it, I, too, have faced that long road of discrimination, and to some extent, I still do.
Ash was stunned by this revelation, his eyes focused on the books scattered on the coffee table. There was the Upanishads, the Puranas, Ramanuja's books, Sriranja Gaudiyam, about surrendering to the gods,
Vaikuntha Gaudiam about the realm of the god Vishnu and meditation, as well as two post-Vedic Hindu scriptures that spoke of the appearance of God on earth. The elder Jeffrey knew every book as they came from his personal library, books Ash never bothered to leaf through during his youth. The dust they gathered over the years was now vacuumed and in the trash. Old man Jeffrey grumbled something unintelligible, meant to be a sure complaint, when in reality he could not express the joy in his heart to discover his son was on to something. Mr. Jeffrey missed his country, the pungent yet fragrant smells, the lush vegetation, the noisy people on a busy street, but mostly, he missed simply being among his tribe and listening to their every conversation, regardless of the subject. He'd stopped being a member of the tribe soon after moving to London, and that was a personal sadness he never shared with a single soul, for he saw the need in acculturating as best as possible to the English way of life. In several words, what Ashley was doing was taking back their culture and putting it to use. Certainly there was much to be accomplished utilizing the ancient scriptures.
What exactly do you intend to do with all of this?
I don't know yet, Ash replied. But my life will be fulfilled through it. Of that I assure you. Father now got up from his comfortable chaise without another word. He shook his head when he really would have preferred to nod in agreement. For the books had, after all, opened up his own world as a young man in India. After that father and son chat, the Jeffrey household magically returned to normal. With Indira feeling better every day, it was as if the exchange between the two men in the household had cleared the air, and in an unexplainable way began the healing process for all. Ash knew Indira was back to her old self, when she asked for a chunk of German chocolate cake. As life happens, there are twists and turns, achievements, failures, happy times, and unbearable moments we must put up with, tighten our seatbelts, and keep going. Now invigorated with new ideas to reboot his life, as Ash put it, he walked the streets looking to identify a missing niche in English culture. A merchant he would not be. Neither would he cater to the wealthy, selling buildings or by starting a restaurant. There were many of both. These daily investigations would lead him to something, as materialistic society must by nature supply its people with every imaginable need. You could find anything in London. He knew that, and so, thirsty for a cup of tea, he stopped by a shop to rest his feet. An old woman sat with her daughter and grandson. The elder entertained by the little boy whose only words were, "Dada, Dada." At another table sat a well-dressed man reading the news while smoking a pipe. Ash felt a sense of calm cover these grueling times, his quiet soul assuring him of the future. A woman on the sidewalk was walking her two doggies, poodles by the looks of it. But something happened next that took Ash by surprise. The dogs stopped in their tracks. The woman, wearing a fine stylish scarf around her neck, stopped too. She muttered something to her pets as if they spoke English, but they would not budge. Instead, the two poodles sat on their haunches, waiting for the next thing to happen. Ash observed the action as if a serious movie on the BBC. Apparently, the dogs wanted something the woman would not provide them. Finally, reaching into her purse, she pulled something out, a snack feeding the dogs that were now wiggling their tails. Happy for the moment, the dogs continued on, following the lady, disappearing from sight. Ash stopped. The idea of catering to the rich was suddenly a good one. He would go home and make a batch of organic dog food and offer it to friends with canines for a good try. If the product was excellent, he would offer it to specialty stores and make a quick buck. There was no such thing as organic dog food in London at the time, and on his hurried walk home, he stopped by the old juice bar. Still alive and kicking after all these years, though now under new ownership. he had the idea to recycle the tossed vegetable fiber, making biscuits to maximize profits. Mother thought him crazy, but then that was nothing new. Ash, with Indira still recovering, but walking about more and more, made a mixture of discarded vegetable fiber, celery, apples, but mostly carrots with powdered protein, adding a sprinkle of flour to make what he called a doggy carrot tart. This little cookie was meant to be a doggy snack anyone could carry around town, put in a coat pocket or in a purse to feed doggy while strolling or at the park. After the first batch was made, he had several pounds and, as the mathematician he aspired to be, calculated the pieces, could sell 10 for a pound. His total cost was 50p for the discarded material, with which he made 250 cookies in all. Not a bad investment, if you ask me, he told Indira when she walked into the kitchen, guided there by the luscious aroma in the air. He could make 25 pounds in notes with this batch if he were in the market, a profit of 24 pounds and 50p. With financial support from Barclays, he started the company, working day and night, making as much product as possible, placing it in stores by day and packaging at night. Soon he made enough money to contribute to the household, though the elder Jeffrey insisted he save for the next venture, which he did. Soon Ash repaid the loan, and success in hand, he began to make plans to return to the United States. The only question was, who would he work for? He needed a working visa, and at that moment, there were no offers forthcoming. Rock Anderson was living large in Orange County. He surfed in Huntington Beach, dined in Newport Beach, attended baseball games at Anaheim Stadium, danced in Hollywood, and generally did as he pleased as a single guy at the top of his game. At work, he was well-liked. His employees went out of their way to please him because he treated them well and with respect. And the business grew, though inch by inch. He was yet to attain the tremendous wealth coming to him, and he knew it. In a matter of time, he would explode financially, meaning be rich beyond his own imagination, and he looked forward to that as part of his destiny in life. The young employees felt at ease to invite him to gatherings and parties, so Rock would occasionally attend one of their events to return what he described as their loyalty to me. One Friday evening, the kids, all wanting to do better in life, all highly motivated and attending Orange Coast College before transferring to UCI, USC, or Stanford, invited Rock to a performance down the street at the Abbey to see a young, amazing, up-and-coming comic magician while sharing a few pitchers of beer. As Rock had no plans that evening, he attended the event, planning to leave soon after to get some much-needed sleep. Still feeling overworked, fat and sloppy looking, Rock took the opportunity to mingle with his staff. "You always buy the beer," one of them said. "That's because I can afford it and because I love you guys," he responded. As it turned out, the magician comic was much more than expected, performing amazing tricks that left the audience in wonder. At once, he made objects disappear while saying that to have them reappear in life would be to return to the past, a past we all want to leave behind. This humorist was more of a psychic, perhaps a teacher. The truth is, at his age, he was 23, he had yet to define himself in the world. The only thing the magician knew is that he had something to say. He was charming, he had something to share with the world, and he was doing it the best way he knew, in the moment. If later this developed, turned into something unexpected or in a different form, he would do that too. Rock was impressed. In just that one show, the young man led him to investigate his own life, wondering if he was carrying the past on his shoulders. His conclusion was that he was a businessman with no time to look back. He never had looked back, and he had no plans of starting now. Business is about right now. What do I need to do now? How do I do it now? And what outcome am I seeking now? That was Rock's basic mantra in life. One thing he was sure of, he would remember the young man's name, Gold. On his way out to the car and after paying the bill, Rock thought he saw a crime in progress, but was mistaken. Instead, it was Gold fixing a flat tire on his old Honda Civic from way back when. The paint was peeling, the customary chrome symbols had been ripped off, and the car's window was cracked.
"Say, Gold,
great performance. Let me give you a hand." Rock proceeded to fix the tire in no time flat, now showing off, but simply by focusing on the task. Gold was impressed.
"Let me buy you a beer. What's your name?"
Back in the bar, Rock took vodka on the rocks. Gold asked questions when it should have been the other way around, as Rock was impressed that he learned something tonight from the magician. The two discovered their lives were similar, because as boys, each had started a business and learned that to work for others wasn't going to work for them. After each acknowledged the other for sharing what seemed like a distant past, and after Gold asked for Rock's business card, they parted ways. In his car, Rock relived the evening. In the end, imagining Gold as a big star one day. How appropriate, he thought. He sees a big future for himself, as I do for myself. Maybe we'll meet again someday.
Hey there, it's Davin Michaels. I hope you're enjoying the book. You're halfway through The Virtual Entrepreneur, and I want to congratulate you. Most people don't make it to the halfway point in a book. As a matter of fact, most people don't complete what they start. So a hearty congratulations to you. I also want to check in with you and make sure that you signed up for your free trial of VIA, the Virtual Entrepreneurs Association, all the tools, discounts, resources, and community that the small business owner needs to grow their business. So if you haven't signed up for your trial, do so now. You can do that at viabiz.org. That's VEABIZ.org. Now back to the story.